Hey folks, I'm Christian, and this is the Ice Age Farmer Podcast. Today, a second half of the conversation with Dr. Anita Bailey, author of Cold Times, Preparing for the Mini Ice Age. You can get this awesome book from octoritaspublishing.org/specials for like 23% off, free shipping. It's a pretty good deal. And I do recommend the book. Everyone's got pretty good feedback about that. This second half of the conversation covers your questions from Patreon and from the Ice Age Farmer Discord. And as well, we'll talk a little bit about some of the things she's doing with her garden. And actually, we get into a whole, even the micronova, we get all over the place. So I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as we did in the first part of the of today's chat, to which I will also link below. We talked about what she is seeing there on the ground in the Ozarks, how conditions are changing, what she's doing to address that, and what some of the scuttlebutt is from ranchers in the area. So check that half of the conversation out as well. Folks, thanks for watching. I hope you're doing well. If you like this conversation, please support this content. Go to patreon.com/iceagefarmer or paypal.me/iceagefarmer. Either way is greatly appreciated. And thanks so much. If you've got questions for Dr. Bailey yourself, feel free to send them to me through those methods or directly at christian@iceagefarmer.com is how you can reach me. All right. With all that said, this is the second part of the conversation. Now let me pivot, because you are also the author of Cold Times, Preparing for the Mini Ice Age, which is an awesome resource for how to for what's coming and then sort of how to brace yourself and become more self-sufficient during these cold times. Let's talk about the spring planting that you're not yet doing, but planning. How are you planning out your garden this year?
Well, what I'm doing is previously we worked in long rows. And as my husband and myself are aging, we're finding that that's a lot less desirable to walk up and down these long rows. So we're breaking it up into 4-foot little semi-beds. We're not making planters, but we're setting them off into 4x4 sections and planting those. And that way we can put potatoes next to peas, next to something else, carrots, and without having to overlap them. And we're thinking, of course, it's another experiment. We're thinking that this will be easier to take care of the weeds than trying to go down a row when you look at it and you go, I don't even want to walk that far, much less hoe it. So this we can go, oh, it's just a little 4x4. I can pick weeds out of that. So it's more psychological than anything else. And just trying to make it so that when we go out in the garden, it's a pleasant experience instead of a horrible ordeal like it was last year. Yeah.
And what about?
So I'd say that,
go ahead.
Yeah, that's the biggest change, I would say, is how we lay things out. I am aiming and have aimed over the years more toward food that is self-perpetuating with little effort. And as we age, I think it's going to be nicer to have to do less work in the garden. So I've got sunchokes, a little bed of sunchokes, and I'll be propagating those in various places.
Mm-hmm.
One set of plants I was real happy with this year, and I've had them in the past but kind of got away from them, replanted again last year, sand cherries or bush cherries, Hansen's bush cherry, and there's a couple other varieties. Those guys are supposed to be hardy to zone 2, which is way up there in the far north. So I was hoping they would be able to set up a good stand before we come into the real bad, nasty cold weather. And they came through the winter fine. They're flowering right now. And so we'll see how they produce this coming year. But their hardiness is quite impressive, quite impressive. So one vote for sand cherries.
Very cool. Tell me,
yeah,
what other perennials are you investing in right now?
Oh, goodness. Well, not investing, but carrying over from past years. We have blueberries, blackberries, strawberries, wild gooseberry, mm-hmm, which I was so excited about last year. I think I mentioned to you way back when. They flowered real beautifully. They had bees and other insects all over the plants. It was wonderful. were sure we were going to get a huge harvest and not a single berry on the wild plants in our garden or the ones in our surrounding area. That's baffling to me. Because gooseberries are another one of those super hardy plants that birds rarely get into, and they're just one of those things you can count on.
Yeah, they're so thorny. I just put a few gooseberries in myself.
Yeah. Uh-huh. They will take over whatever area they're in and keep sending down new little starts. You can start them just by poking a branch under the dirt, put a rock on it to hold it down, and in the fall it will be rooted, and now you've got a new plant. So they're good for that. Also make a real good hedge if you want to keep somebody out of an area, because nobody wants to go through the gooseberries.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
What about in terms of caloric needs? Do you take that kind of a lens to how you plan out your garden?
Well, I know some people do, and I think the best source of calories is meat and fat. So if you have your chickens and your bunnies and maybe a goat, you are meeting your primary caloric needs then. Potatoes are an excellent source. They're highly productive, comparatively, in terms of calories and nutrients and ease of growing them. Turnips are good. You get a large weight out of a production of turnips, but they're very low calorie. Same thing with sprouts. I love sprouts, but you'd have to eat, 15 pounds of sprouted sprouts to get enough to get by on a day. And they're just so low calorie. You can't really count on them except as a side dish or a nutrient filler, whatever. But yes, in terms of production, potatoes and tomatoes are supposed to be the highest producers per amount of space that they're in for the weight of your production. Tomatoes, of course, are a fruit, and they have benefits that go with being a fruit as opposed to being a vegetable. So, but no, I don't use the calorie method of figuring out what to grow. I use the do I like this or do I not like this method.
that's a good yardstick as well, yeah. I was going to ask the same question about protein. Do you take a look at how much protein you'll be needing over the course of a year? But it sounds like the answer is animals, yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We typically will butcher one calf, 800-pounder, per year, and that will feed us and extended family, at least supplementing extended family, kids and grandkids and relatives and people who come over, get a party favor, here's your beef, you know, and that kind of thing. So we have two or three freezers just full of beef. If the power goes off, we're going to be doing a lot of canning in a big hurry. So, and of course the goats, and there's goat's milk, goat meat, chickens. They have started laying at a knock you unconscious rate right now. So we compel anyone who comes to the house to take eggs with them, whether they want them or not. and of course, I've been pickling eggs again. There's a little shop in a nearby town that gets damaged freight, and they got a big shipment of this wonderful Italian wine vinegar, white wine vinegar, which is, the flavor is just out of this world. So I've been pickling eggs in that. And having a wonderful time, and the price was really, really good on it. So
nice.
It was actually cheaper than if I made my own wine vinegar. So that was nice.
Perfect.
It's always nice to see that.
Yeah, definitely. Do you guys grow cover crops in the off season?
No, we do not.
Okay.
And we have our fields are constantly in hay. And in fall, when we put the garden to bed, we cover it with leftover hay, and that breaks down, turns into mulch in the garden.
Yeah. Okay.
Um, and And it's been very good for the soil. We've seen over the past 5-6 years, the soil really improved tremendously. And so we'll probably continue with that. This area typically requires liming. So every now and then we will lime the hay fields. We haven't probably, goodness, for 7 or 8 years, maybe. And it really should have been done last year, probably. But, you know, we weren't the only ones who didn't get a harvest, so it wasn't a lack of lime. We also drag the fields. When the cattle have been on them for a while, their manure is spread all over the place. If you leave it where it is, the cows won't eat in that area. They don't like to eat around somebody else's poo, I guess. Although the grass will grow huge and green there.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to make sure that the whole area gets manured, you take a device called a drag and hook it up to your pickup or tractor and drive all over the field. And the drag is like a rake, mm-hmm. multi-prong rake. And so it drags that manure all over the place and breaks up the surface of the soil a little bit. So you get the benefit of breaking up heavy roots and what have you, and adding the manure back to the soil at a more uniform rate. So that's a good thing.
Very cool. When you are planting in your garden, do you set aside some space for basically for crops that are going to grow, chop and drop, and put them back into the ground, feeding the garden itself as opposed to yourself?
Everything that we don't eat gets turned back under.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think that would fit your chop and drop.
Definitely.
Unless you're looking at simply leaving stuff on the surface. We have, we generally have a really good crop of lamb's quarters throughout the garden. Lamb's quarters is a weed. I believe they're an amaranth relative. And they can grow 3 or 4 feet tall and have just wonderfully flavored spinachy, sort of asparagus-y flavored leaves that are, you can cook them or you can eat them fresh. And so that has over the years now become one of those perennial crops. When the plants are done and the seeds are done, I break them off and just leave them on the ground. At some point, I need to make some paths in the garden, and I've been saying this now for 6 years. So maybe I will, maybe I won't. But once again, you know, you look forward and you say, I want to make it so it's easy and fun instead of horrible and backbreaking toil.
Yes, ma'am.
It's never backbreaking, but yeah, it's hot and you're sweaty and you walk out there with your hoe and you just dread going out and dealing with it.
So. Oh, it's a ton of work, no doubt, yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
We mentioned the global protein shortage that's in the headlines right now. Those are scary words. What advice would you have for someone who's hearing those words and then wondering how to spin up their own protein pipeline?
Chickens or rabbits.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the most familiar kind of animals to raise. If you have 3 hens, you'll be getting, on average, 2 to 3 eggs a day. In, 4 or 5 days, you've got a dozen eggs, or 10 months out of the year. You will not, if you're anything like the average person, you won't be able to use that much. We're getting 30 eggs a day now, so, and we don't use that much. So, in 10 days, eggs are all over your house and up to your knees. So, that's an excellent resource. Chickens that have access to the outside world, a little run where they can eat grass and eat bugs, can feed themselves. So your expense of keeping them is much lower than it would be if you had to feed them day and night.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in a suburban area, and many suburban areas are now much more amenable to chickens, if you can't keep chickens, rabbits are a good resource. Now, rabbits are friendly, they're quiet, They're clean. Their manure can go right in your potted plants or out in your garden. Wonderful, wonderful manure. If you're in a city situation, you could probably keep two small rabbit cages that is 30 inches by 30 inches by 16, I think, in height, and be able to produce one a male, one a female. The female can produce a litter almost every month, 11 litters in a year, if you're breeding continuously. If you breed her three times a year and she has, say, 10 bunnies a litter, which would be pretty normal, and you wait until they're about 5 pounds each before you butcher them, that's 50 pounds of meat. Meat and bones. Bones make soup. Soup is protein. So you have a really good source there. Now, like I said, rabbits are cute and they're cuddly and they're friendly and inquisitive. And for people who have only raised pet animals, dogs and cats, it's real easy to get attached to them.
Yeah.
And when butchering day comes, it's really, really hard. The only advice I can give you is that if you've raised your animals well and they've had a wonderful life and they've had plenty to eat and been treated well, then make their end quick, and it's a whole lot nicer than it would be out in the wild.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you fed them, they feed you. It's a good relationship.
Now, with those rabbits, I've read that they won't breed if it gets too hot. I'm not sure about cold. Tell me about their temperature sensitivity.
Some breeds are more sensitive than others. The thicker their hair is, the harder it is for them to breed. They become sterile, effectively, during the summer heat. Okay. So, now, we raise rabbits in Southern California, and as you know, it can get pretty warm down there.
Mm-hmm.
But our rabbits were fairly adapted to the warmer weather. So in an area that has a cool winter, they can do well. They can breed throughout the whole winter. If they're not in a shed or building or something like that, where you can protect them from the elements, you may lose bunnies, because when the moms hop in the nest, which is a special box you put in with them, to feed the babies, and then will hop right out. They don't stay in the nest with the babies. And when they hop out, sometimes the baby will be attached to a nipple and won't let go, and that baby gets dragged out. Now, the moms are different than dogs and cats. They won't pick up a baby and put it back in the nest. Dog or a cat will. So that's something you have to be on the lookout for. They're prey animals, and so they don't want to be in a position where they're attracting predators toward their nest. So they don't spend time in the nest, and when they go out, they try not to go back again for several hours. It's just the nature of the beast.
Mm. Great advice. Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah, but the heat problem... A lot of times, if you what do they call them, a swamp cooler, a piece of cloth moistened with water a couple times a day so the wind blows through it, will cool down that area sufficiently. Or you can give your rabbits a 2 or 3 month break.
Perfect. Anita, I've been getting a lot of folks who'd called me crazy only a month or years ago that are now returning and saying, hey, wow, it looks like I'm seeing what you were telling me was going to happen. And so, and are having their minds changed by what their eyes are seeing. So I was just, can I ask for your data point on this? Are you having any change with response to your message or your book?
Well, I'm not a big reader of book reviews.
Mm-hmm.
Or any kind, because I'm very easily led astray by them. People either love it or they hate it. And if they love it, then your head swells up really big. And if they hate it, you have to kill somebody. So I try to avoid that. So I can't say that I've really looked in great detail at that. Now, one thing on the home setting, I have adult children. And over the years, I have encouraged them to prepare. And, of course, they're normal people like anybody in our society who go, my mom's nuts. She's like a meat hoarder. You should see her freezer. But now I'm hearing them say things like, you got any extra beef? Because I'm like down to my last 20 pounds. Okay, this is good. So, you know, there's some eyes opening there and some consciousness that things are different.
Yeah.
The businesses that my children are in, one of them is in, it's like an ice cream. She works at the headquarters of an ice cream company. And their price on vanilla, they use the Madagascar vanilla, that took a huge jump from $100 or something a gallon, which is crazy high as far as I'm concerned, but it went up close to $1,000 a gallon.
If you can even get it. Yeah, it's...
Yeah, yeah. And they were actually talking about changing to a less pricey vanilla.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure if they did or not, but wow. That's quite a change. And that can be an eye-opener to somebody who's sort of on the fence as well. A distant relative who had been looking for some real plump beef and wanted to get a hold of it, said he hasn't been able to find any, which was another interesting thing. He prefers real fatty meat, and our animals are more lean, so he's not terribly interested in that, but he can't find a fat beef to butcher. That's odd.
Well, I will honor the fact that you don't read reviews, but I will just submit that, in my opinion, it remains the best, most comprehensive guide to preparing for the times ahead. And the feedback that I've gotten from people that have picked it up is universally positive. It's really well received. So thank you for
that. Well, I'm glad to hear that. My head is starting to swell. Careful.
Well, then let's get into some more questions. Some folks on the Ice Age Farmer Patreon and in the Discord, I just asked for some questions and got a collection here, so we can dive into those and put our egos back in check. Let's see.
Okay.
From Carolyn on Twitter, who also says, I love her book. Thank you so much. What are the most important characteristics we should look for when we're looking for a property? I know to try and stay south of perhaps 40 degrees latitude, but what about elevation? Should I be close to a town or more remote? And what are your thoughts?
Well, that's something that becomes more of a personal issue.
Yeah.
If I had my druthers, I would be out in the middle of a wilderness, somewhere where nobody could find me unless I wanted them to find me. But I got to live in this world with other people, so every now and then I go to a supermarket, and it's nice having a Walmart 20 miles away or 30 miles away. When I want something from there, shoelaces or what have you. So I understand the desire to be in a situation where you don't have to spend a half a day driving down to get a pound of flour or whatever.
Yeah.
In my mind, thinking forward, if things go very badly, it gets cold, really cold, it gets... we have food shortages and what have you. I suspect, and of course I can't say for sure, but my guess is that a lot of the harder rural areas will empty.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's people living out in these areas right now who are already marginal. It's hard for them to get by, whatever reason, personal issues or just not having the concept of being able to save or whatever it is. And if things get really bad, they can't live out here anymore. They can't. You need the technology right now to live fairly comfortably. If the technology goes away, I think you will have very small pockets of people who have to work together in order to survive. That's a guess. I think it fits the historical model, the way things have happened in the past. People move to the city first because they know there's jobs and they know they can get on welfare or they can get some kind of food because the cities don't want to turn into chaos. if the power grid goes down, all bets are off. I can't even imagine that world. We don't instantly drop back into the 1850s because the 1850s had an existing infrastructure. They didn't have electricity, but they had towns. They had delivery schedules, railroads. They had Sears Roebuck, for goodness sakes. You want something, you can order it, just like Amazon. We don't have that anymore. We don't have the infrastructure that would allow us to live at an 1850s level in today's world. We just don't. So should that grid go down, I don't know, 1600, 1400? I don't know.
It's hard to say, and there would be a period of turbulence, right? A hard landing before there'd even be something you could describe as normalcy. Somebody actually was pointing out a really good point the other day, which is that during that rough landing, you would be well advised to keep the smells to a minimum because hungry people, you know, the smell of scent is pretty underrated for humans. And hungry people will be able to smell food cooking for miles potentially around. So you'll need to be under the radar, right? The gray man would actually encompass your own smells there for a while as well.
Yes, that's true. And not only cooking foods, but your outhouse or where your latrine. You have to make sure you cover that up because human waste has a peculiar odor that's different than other animals. The sound of your rooster would be something you wouldn't want your neighbors to necessarily hear.
Yeah.
Wow. And the same thing, a generator, if you had that. In fact, even in the next year or two, I would encourage anyone with a generator to build a special shed that is soundproof to run your generator in. Make sure you have a way for the exhaust to get out of there.
Yeah.
And because people steal generators now, and if we really have issues with the power going down because of weather or whatever, generators are going to be a hot commodity, and you can hear those over the hill and dale.
That's right. And of course, the better answer would be not to be near people that are going to be hostile, but that's not always possible. Let's back away from the Mad Max world and go to the next question. Where can I find cold, hardy, short season crops, especially seeds for pastures that will yield high protein in a shorter, colder climate? This gentleman is in Nebraska and he is seeing the changes firsthand.
He's looking for a seed source rather than seed varieties.
I think both.
Yeah, okay. If he's looking toward pasture, he needs to get with his extension agent and ask that exact question. If he's looking for edible garden seeds, I think a good resource is rareseeds.com.
Yeah.
That's Baker Seed Company. If they don't have something, then their catalog is beautiful. It, by itself, it's just a gorgeous thing. But they will describe if something has a reputation for being good short season, grows fast, and all of that. And you can call them and ask. Hey, look, this is what I'm looking for. Well, what do you got? For pasture, clovers are great. They're putting protein and nutrients and nitrogen and everything good in the soil. Red clover is particularly good at that, and you can trim it and make tea from it. Keep in mind that red clover can, fresh red clover as a graze, can induce temporary sterility in a lot of your pasture animals.
Wow.
So I wouldn't be having them graze red clover. Red clover hay is fine. So if you're looking for a baby crop, that's not the way to do it.
I did not know that. Wow.
Yeah, one of those little oddities. Maybe not all your cows are barren, but some will be. So
that's an important safety note. Speaking of safety, here's another question. How can I, you know, in fact, there's an entire chapter in your book, Cold Times, about safety and security. And this woman asks, how can I form, you know, basically a mutual assistance group? How do I network to find these people discreetly without revealing that I'm a prepper?
This is the trick question of the week. Ultimately, at some point, you have to reveal something. Because think of this. You're out in a rural area, and the people all around you are, maybe a percentage of them are preppers too, and they're holding their cards close to their chest and laying low.
Mm-hmm.
And you come in and say, hey, who wants to join a club for preppers? They will leave the room. Like, okay, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
What we have done over the years is we've just kind of watched people. And after a while, you start seeing the characteristics of folks that you know are thinking in a way similar to you. And I'll give you an example. We were at a medical building and sitting in the lobby, and people are coming and going. One fella comes in, and he has a pack, you know, kind of a man purse thing, except it's a little bigger, and it's got some, Velcro strips on it. And I'm looking at this pack and going, this is kind of odd, because that looks like a Maxpedition, which is a brand of these little carriers. As I'm watching the guy, I realize it is Maxpedition. Not only that, it's the one that's got the secret gun thing on top where you can put your hand into the top, and he's got a little bump in his bag. He might be carrying a gun. Uh-huh. And so, and then I noticed he has, on the side of it, he's got a water bottle Velcroed to it, and on the other side, he's got a flint and steel lighter. Now, this isn't something you see in a big city very much.
Yeah.
And we were in a big city at the time. This guy, he's either a Boy Scout leader or he is a real hardcore prepper who thinks he's going to have to light a fire on the sidewalk somewhere. And so I kind of moseyed over and had a little brief conversation with him. And, well, I like your bag. That's an expedition, isn't it? Oh, yeah, and it's got pockets here, and it's got this and that. So, yeah, I think there was one. And I didn't say, are you a prepper, or do you have, or do you put things back? But I'm pretty sure he did. And so now we got a buddy. Of course, it was a, you know, buddy of 5 minutes. But if you see somebody like that in your area, and you look at them and go, that guy's got a zombie apocalypse vehicle. That's a four-wheel drive truck with a, let me see, 1967, pre-1979, won't go down during the coronal mass ejection. I like this guy. Let me look at your truck, buddy. Now we can talk about your truck for a while. And then you casually mention zombies and... And I mean, that's the humorous side of it. Nobody's really, I don't think many people are really thinking zombies, but you can use it as your code worm. That's your zombie bug out vehicle. And, you know, you're able to spot it after a while. Now, how do you cozy up with people? Well, preppers are, by necessity, kind of like cats. They function well on their own or within their small circle, and they... In my experience, most preppers tend to be people who are maybe a little above average intelligence, sometimes a lot. I've known physicians who were preppers and very, very quiet about it. So you can see that they're doing things differently, and you can recognize that they know they're outside of the mainstream, just like we know we're outside of the mainstream.
Yeah.
And that makes us a little hesitant to stand up in the supermarket line and say, who's got food stored at home?
Yeah.
You know, because if there's preppers there, they're going to ignore you or walk away. If there aren't preppers there, you're going to get all kinds of stories. Oh, no, heck no, I buy food every day. So you have to be discreet. You can't build a relationship over a day, a week, a month, or a year. You have to build it over time. So now's a good time to, if you want to meet those people, gun ranges are a good place to meet people who have an interest, but you have to use your discretion.
Mm-hmm.
Just because somebody has an interest doesn't mean they're actually doing anything.
That's right.
It's a lot easier to talk about it and to get on the internet and write, you know, great polemics about how you need to prepare and not do it yourself.
Gun ranges is a good one. I was going to add to that, gardening groups is a good place. Mm-hmm. Neighborhood watches, if there's a neighborhood watch. You got to say church groups, obviously. CERT trainings, if your county has a CERT emergency preparedness training, those are folks who are, this is like where normies kind of chip away at the edges of what your intentions are. And so those are places where you can sort of jumpstart that search.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely right.
Here's very a question. Good. Oh, go ahead.
No, that's, you made some very good points.
Awesome. Here's a question from Jeff in the Discord. What is driving people like Attenborough to continue to perpetuate the lies of global warming when it is they that should be the people that understand what solar cycles are? It's just baffling that they're so roped into the fraud.
Mm-hmm. There was a book written many, many years ago, probably back in the, oh goodness, I think 1920s, maybe 30s. And it was about spiritualism, which was a religious philosophy that involved seances and calling up the spirits of the dead people who would appear in these clouds of ectoplasm mist and you know, give advice to their family relatives and things like that. Fairly benign kind of thing, giving a lot of people hope and positivity about the future. And Harry Houdini, the great magician at the time, was one of his things was to expose a lot of spiritualists as frauds. They, you know, they made a lot of money doing it, so it was okay, and their followers were great believers. Well, one of the exposed spiritualists had this, he would have a meeting every week, and he would answer questions, supposedly from the spirit world. Well, he used a very simple method of palming one question and answering that question. It's something magicians are familiar with. Well, anyway, he was doing this, and he was exposed in front of his congregation, and some of his various tricks, the things that he used in the seances to create the mists and the ghost-like forms and things were all trotted out and shown to his followers. And three or four people out of several hundred there left. They were so upset and, you know, they were bothered. The rest of them stayed on and said, "We support you. We know that these people are evil and just want to shut you down." So there is something in people, in their heads, that makes them remain convinced to some deeply held belief. So Attenborough, does he totally believe this to the point where he blocks out all contradictions? Could be. Could be. And I think that I'm being generous in that, because a part of me, the cynic, says, the guy's getting paid. You know, what's the big deal? He's making millions. So, you know, duh, he's saying it because he makes money. But I don't know that. So generously, he may be totally convinced in the truth of it, have stopped inquiring to see if things have changed enough that he shouldn't believe it, and consequently goes on with what he believes to be true. So there you go. That's what I think. Either it's a self-delusion, it's a comfort with the beliefs that you have and not wanting to look outside them, or it's a, you know, this is my income, so I'm going to do whatever it takes.
Yeah, you can't convince a man whose paycheck depends on believing. Right? Or the other one, it's harder to convince a man that he's been fooled than to teach him that. Yeah, that's
exactly right. Exactly,
I think too many people just don't question what the establishment is telling them. It's just too much.
And that's, I want to briefly aside on the solar nova issue. You know, Doug Vogt and Suspicious Observers and some other folks have brought that up. If you look into that in great detail, it's so horrifying, you almost can't go there. I mean, waves, you know, miles high, sweeping over entire continents to the point where everything is swept away except for a few little mountain peaks. I can't even go there in my thinking. But when I try to, it makes preparing for the mini ice age just a breeze.
That's true.
All I have to do is stock up food and make sure my house doesn't get crushed by ice.
Not a problem.
So that's easy. So anyway, yeah.
Well, and so since you brought it up, what's your take on the micronova?
Well, I've heard similar for a number of years. Paul Violette had written along those lines. Dr. Robert Schock, who is a geologist, I believe, had become convinced that they may have been responsible for some of the changes in the Egyptian dynasties and the Sphinx and things like that. So people who are pretty smart look at it and say, this could be. But I don't know. I just don't know. I think Doug Vogt, as bright as he is, as careful as his scholarship has been, when you have one person doing something, they're going to miss stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be blank spots. There's going to be feedback loops in your own head that says, yeah, that fits.
Yeah.
And so that puts a small question mark on it. Now, I'm not saying he's wrong. I'm saying that that's typical when you're doing research on your own. You're just going to miss something. You just are, because you're a human. Now, maybe he missed that it's way worse than he thinks. But you know, I sure don't know. But I know in order to get to 2046 or 2048, whichever one it is, you're going to have to get through the mini ice age first.
That's right, yeah.
So that's what I'm aiming toward.
Yeah, the immediacy and the certainty of what we're facing now is, yeah, I think, merits right. discussion.
That's it.
Mm-hmm. There are many more questions, Anita, that I would love to ask you, but I can't believe how time has flown. And actually, I'd love to make this a more regular conversation in the future. Is there a question I should have asked, or is there anything else you'd like to share?
No, I think you've covered it pretty darn good. And I'd be happy to do that at any point in the future.
Awesome. In that case, I have one final question, and that is, okay. What is your favorite thing about spring in the Ozarks?
Ooh, the first flowers on the forsythia bush. They're yellow, and one day it looks like there's no flowers, and the next day the whole bush is covered with these 1 inch or less bright yellow little flowers. And that's spring. Wait, even something earlier than that. The little frogs, they're called spring peepers. They're some little baby frogs that usually appear sometime in February. And they will start setting up a chorus at night. And to me, that's how you know spring is for sure on the way. And then they get frozen and they stop singing. I'm sad, but it's those two things, the spring peepers and the forsythia.
Beautiful. Thank you for that.
Forsythia is everywhere. It's just everywhere. Look it up on the net and go, oh, I know some people who got those.
Beautiful. Yeah. Thank you for that. Okay, finally, tell me about the book. I know that from octoritaspublishing.org/specials, you can get more than 20% off because of free shipping. And I've got a link down below in the description. It's a fantastic book. I'm not even getting paid to say that. Are there other projects you're working on or other ways folks can support you?
Actually, right now I'm working on kind of a follow-up book to that on the risk of a CME during the grand solar minimum.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to explore the history of CMEs and the potential risks, what we know about them. The fact that our president came out with this recent executive order on the 26th, the last month.
That's right.
That he wanted the EMP issue explored in quite a bit of detail, and he didn't want to waste any time. He said, have this on my desk in 180 days. It's like, he's pretty serious about this.
Yeah.
Does that mean it's a problem? Somebody thinks it's a problem. So we'll see what happens with that. Now, can they rescue everything if they start right now? Can they make sure CMEs don't knock out all the grid? No, they can't. They may be able to provision for small islands of civilization, maybe some towns. My guess would be that they'll have a lot of pressure to save New York and Chicago and Los Angeles and Seattle and places like that. But I think they would prefer medium-sized towns that are a little bit separated.
Mm-hmm.
My guess, I don't know, I got no insight on that, but if I was up there in the planning, I'd say, you know, we can't save New York, but we might be able to save Memphis. So, planners, you never know what they're going to come up with, and then they might come up with something so fanciful it's not going to happen anyway.
Yeah. Well, there's no question that there's an issue there, right? With the magnetosphere waning, even if there weren't risk of huge CMEs, we were already, our shields are down. So there's no question there. And they have already built their underground bases. So yeah, this is the first public facing acknowledgement and perhaps preparation. Mm-hmm. We'll see.
Yep. That's right. That's exactly right. So I don't think it would harm any of us to have preparation that focus on that as a part of the general cold weather thing.
Definitely.
Just keep thinking. It's not a solar nova. All I have to do is get food and water and, you know, make sure my roof won't fall in.
Piece of cake.
Right. Exactly.
Dr. Anita Bailey, thank you so much again for taking the time to speak with me today. I appreciate it.
It's always my pleasure, Christian.